The parsha of Kisetse is packed with mitzvahs, as the greatest number of mitzvahs per parsha in the Torah. And I'd like to begin by taking a look at the psukim that relate to the mitzvah of ma'akeh, building a fence around one's roof. They're actually to be found in Shlishi. It's a good place to start. Everyone secretly always looks towards Shlishi anyway. Let's move straight there. In Perek Kaf Beis, Pasuk Ches, Kisiv Nebayis Chodosh. When you build a new house, Vasisa Ma'ake Lekagecha, you should make a fence around the roof. Velo Sasim Dome Bebesecha, do not have blood or cause for blood in your house. Ki Polano Fomimeno, a person could fall. And that is the very well-known mitzvah of ma'akeh. Everyone knows if you have an elevated surface where people could fall, whether it's a roof, whether it's a merpeset, there is a mitzvah of ma'akeh. Actually, my comments with regards to this mitzvah are not about ma'akeh itself, but I would like to just mention one thing which is very interesting. On the face of it, this mitzvah of ma'akeh, putting a fence around your roof, is the most intuitive and seicheldik of mitzvahs one can imagine. After all, one has an obligation, any situation of danger, to avoid danger. What could be more common sense and more self-explanatory, perhaps, than this mitzvah of ma'akeh? However, if we look at some of the basic halachas of ma'akeh, we will see that it is not perhaps as intuitive as we would think. For the simple reason that there are many structures which have no obligation of ma'akeh. How does it begin? The pasuk says, "Ki sivne bayis chadash vasisa ma'akeh legagecha." If you build a new house, so make a fence around the roof. The Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Sukkah explains that the mitzvah of making a fence applies specifically, therefore, to a structure which is called a bayis, a house, and moreover, to a house where people live. And what that means is, for example, although we don't normally see this, a house or even a large structure where people don't live, even if people are there, but it's not a dwelling, has no mitzvah whatsoever of ma'akeh. For example, a shul. People don't live in shul, not anymore. And because it doesn't answer to the full definition of bayis, it doesn't have the mitzvah of ma'akeh. The question, of course, is why ever not? We're not afraid that people will fall off the roof of the shul as surely as they could fall off the roof of a house. If falling is falling. How can there be any exceptions to the rule of ma'akeh if it's such a blatant and obvious requirement? It's practically pikuach nefesh. But the truth of the matter is, says Chazon Ish, that's not necessarily the case at all. When you think about it, any house, and we'll get to actually, one could say, actively dangerous situations in just a moment, but any house has the wherewithal potentially for terrific danger. Having said that, we do rely on whoever is in the house to protect themselves. That's within the realms of normalcy. Normal household appliances can be deadly. A toaster could cause a terrible accident. A toaster, there's no ban on toasters in halacha. We assume that whoever is using the appliance will not do so either with wet hands, and they won't stick their hand in the toaster just to make sure that it's getting toasted on all sides, etc. and so forth. It's mutter for a person to have sharp knives. We're not worried that a guest may perhaps hold the blade instead of holding the handle. I mean, they're as dangerous as potentially as certain things are, that is counterbalanced by the protection that a person has in using them. And the same is true in principle, says the Chazon Ish, with regards to a roof. You're worried that a person will fall off a roof. Why are you worried? First of all, who is up there and why are they up there? By definition, whoever goes up onto a roof will do so with the care that one takes when one is potentially in danger of falling. If you walk down a flight of stairs, you're in danger of falling if you don't take them one by one. If you just walk in a straight line, you're asking for trouble. And therefore, the truth is, in terms of what we would have imagined to be the glaring danger issue, it's not that dangerous because it's self-selecting in terms of who puts themselves on the roof and under what circumstances do they do so. If we imagine that there were no fences, there probably would not be that many people that fell off. And if they did, they may have other problems. And therefore, what's behind the mitzvah of makkah, in a sense, is an added protection, and that's why there are already distinctions to be made, specifically for a dwelling, not necessarily for other buildings, etc., and so forth. So that's there's a great deal to think about there, in terms of perhaps conclusions that we would have instantly drawn are not as straightforward as they may seem. But within the mitzvah of makkah, there is this extra phrase, "Velo sosim damim beveisecha," don't have blood in your house. What does this mean? On a simple level, it is playing out the Torah's description of makkah. Build a fence, lo sosim damim beveisecha, is the outcome if a person doesn't make a fence around their roof. However, the Gemara sees this expression, lo sosim damim beveisecha, as an extra prohibition or an extra instruction barring anything that is actually dangerous from the house. What are examples? The Gemara says in Maseches Baba Kama on Daf Tesvav Amud Beis, Rabbi Nosson Omer, Minayin Shelo Yigadel Adam Kelev Rab Asoch Beiso. From where do we know that a person should not rear a dangerous dog in his house and then have other people come in who could potentially be really come to danger? Or to have a weak ladder, a dodgy ladder, where a person could do unawares be going up the ladder and it's not fit, it's not safe. Talmud Lomar, to that end, the Torah says, V'lo sosim damim beveisecha. It is the extra injunction not to have anything dangerous in your house. But we can see that in those situations, it's a danger that your average guest perhaps might not be able to protect himself. Maybe he can't protect himself against a dangerous dog. He doesn't know to take precautions with regards to a ladder. Normal ladders are quite strong. And thus, we have this injunction against having a dangerous dog. The question is, what are you meant to do? And what's the response? One can't, if there is a dangerous dog in the house or around, Rashi says, the response is you have to put it down. Ad de mesalek hazeka, you have to remove the danger by killing the dog. If he's a danger, so it's almost like habala horgacha ashkash kim bahorgo. Although the Rambam, interestingly, in the Halachas in Mishneh Torah and Hilchos Nizkei states, a person should not have in his house things that are dangerous, velo es hakelev, and also not a dangerous dog. Ela im kein haya kashur b'shalshalos, unless it's chained. If it's chained, it might cause people a bit of a fright. But at the end of the day, if the chain's a good chain, so in reality, there's no danger. So we have an interesting situation here. According to Rashi, there can be no such thing in the house. And if it's a danger, it has to be put down. Whereas according to Rambam, if it's a danger, the danger can be constrained. The dog can be chained or leashed. I came across a wonderful comment from the Torah Tamima, just to see the attention to detail as people go through Torah and go through Shas. The Torah Tamima says, it appears to me in this debate between Rashi and Rambam, what should one do with a dangerous dog? Do you put it down? Perhaps one doesn't need to, just to chain it. I think that there's support from the Rambam from the Gemara. Where? In Maseches Nedarim, on Daf Samech Hei. What do we find there? Of course, Nedarim deals with Nedarim. A person takes a neder, and as we know, we're coming up to Kol Nidre. Sometimes, when a person takes a neder, things could develop which then render the neder moot or irrelevant. And the Gemara discusses the following case. It's a Mishnah, actually. Rabbi Meir speaks. What if a person takes a neder that he's not going to enter a certain house? But he explains why. Here it is. It's not because of the cooking. He explains why. kolam labayis zeh. He takes a neder with regards to that house. Shani nifnas. I am not entering that house by force of vow. Why? Shakelev rabasoko. Because there's a dangerous dog in there. Oshanachosh basoko. There's a snake in there. Okay, that's his vow. That's his prerogative. But then, what if the following development took place? Omrda, if they said to him, Meisakelev. Well, okay, we heard your vow, but did you know the dog died? Oshanerek anachosh. Or the snake was killed. Says Rabbi Meir, under those circumstances, because it was expressly part of his vow, that that's the reason why. If the reason goes away, the vow goes away by itself. That's Rabbi Meir. We won't go into the particulars of the halacha, but that's the... So, what are we doing in the Gemara Nedarim? How is this helping us? Says the Torah Tamima, we find the most fascinating thing. Let's remind ourselves. This person stated that by force of vow, he's not going to go into this house because of one of two dangerous situations, either a dangerous dog or a snake. But he subsequently was told that the danger has gone away. How did this happen? Let's see the formula. The Mishnah says, Amrula, they said to him, either Meis HaKelev, the dog died, or Neherag HaNachash, the snake was killed. Says the Torah Tamima, now why does it say the snake was killed? Because if there's a snake there, there's a mitzvah to kill it. But if it's also true that the obligation is basically to put down a dog that's dangerous, so then why did the Mishnah shift the scenario from the snake being killed to the dog dying? It should have said they killed the snake, they killed the dog. I mean, that's what needs to be done. Rather, says Torah Tamima, you see from the nuance that whereas with the snake it says it was killed because that's what has to happen, with regards to the dog goes away because the dog dies, but it doesn't need to be killed because it can be chained up, as per the Rambam. So that's a very, I'm not sure how many other people were thinking of this Rashi and Rambam dispute as they were in the heartland of Maseches Nedarim, but that's the trademark of Gedolei Yisrael, to be conscious and aware of everything at all times. You never know when something will make a difference. Now, there is a follow-up, and that is the Mishnah later on in Baba Kama discusses certain takonos that were made. Certain takonos just basically for the general peace. And one of them is Lo yigadel adam esakelev ele imkein hayakosher bishalsheles. You should not raise a dog unless it's leashed, I guess, at the appropriate times. One always needs to have the dog contained. Now, the simple question is, as far as we know, how is this a takana? This is Torah law. We derive from the words lo sasim damim bevesecha that there's a Torah prohibition against having a dog around. What then was room for this further enactment, this new takana, which is seems to be reiterating what the Torah itself said? Well, some people say that there was a general prohibition against having any dogs, and that's an interesting shaila. Jews and dogs have an interesting relationship. It's as much emotional as it is halachic. Just historically, the dogs were never really on the Jews' side. But there are those who say that there's an essential blanket ban against having any dogs, and that was the original, that was the further takana. The Torah bans dangerous dogs. The takana banned all dogs. However, the Shulchan Aruch says, no, it's specifically kelev ra, a bad dog, in which case the question comes back, that's already covered by the Torah's prohibition, lo sasim damim beveisecha. So now the question is, what is a bad dog? Well, Rashi, in his commentary to the Mishnah there, says mipnei shenosheich uminabeach, because it bites and it barks. And that seems from Rashi that the definition of a bad dog is someone who barks and bites. However, the Marshal states that either of these is a problem. Either a dog that bites, or even a dog that doesn't bite, but it barks in a way that causes anxiety or fear. For some people, they can react that way. They hear a dog barking, can really terrify them. That's also part of the prohibition. It's little reassurance when the owner of the dog says it's okay, he doesn't bite, and he's just barking at full force. It doesn't always reassure people. And some suggest that that is the what was added by the second takana, as if to say, when the Torah forbids having a dangerous dog, that's actually a dog that can physically kill, it would bite, etc. But as far as the Torah is concerned, if it just, quote-unquote, barks, that is not something that the Torah forbids, but that was what the additional takana came to ban as well. So it's interesting to see how what begins with the mitzvah of ma'akeh, with everything they say about good fences making good neighbors, there's other things inside the house as well, as the discussion continues to these matters. I'd like to move from there to one of the well-known sections of Kisetse, and that is Amonu Moav, which is in Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Dalet. We'll see Dalet Hey and Vav. We'll see the Psukim together, and then get to the point to which we wish to get. Le'avo Amoni Moavi Bekal Hashem. Someone from Amonu Moav cannot enter the congregation of Hashem, and as we know, what that means is it's not that they cannot convert and become Jewish, but they cannot, having done so, marry into the Jewish people. Gam Dor Asiri, even the 10th generation, it's indefinite. Lo Yovel Hem Bekal Hashem Ad Olam. We discussed the implications for Rus Moavi Vela Moavis just not too long ago at all. And then the Mishnah gives, then the Pasuk gives the reason why. Al devar shelo kidmaschem balechem uvamayim. You see, they didn't come towards you with bread and water, but derech betzischem in Mitzrayim. That's the first indictment, right? They didn't come and provide food and drink for you when you left Mitzrayim. And secondly, vashe sochar alecha es bilam min ba'or, mipasor araim laraim milkal alecha. And also they, although by they we mean specifically Moab here, hired Bilam to curse you. Now, the background, I believe, is well known. But what's most interesting is the way the pasuk continues. V'lo avo Hashem Elokecha lishmo el Bilam. But Hashem did not want to listen to Bilam. V'yafoch Hashem Elokecha l'cho esaklol levrocha. And Hashem reversed the curse to blessing. Ki ahev Hashem Elokecha, because Hashem loves you. It didn't occur to me until today to note how this pasuk vav is very interesting in terms of wondering what it adds to the, shall we say, halachic situation here. As if to say, pasuk dalet gave us a ban. That's the halacha. Lo yavo amoni umavi bekal Hashem. That's the law. Pasuk hey gave the reason. Why? For the following two reasons. They didn't come with bread and water, and they hired Bilam to curse you. Pasuk vav, it doesn't seem to add anything in terms of explaining what it is that they did that was so wrong. It just adds that as much as Bilam tried to damage you, Hashem didn't allow it to happen because Hashem loves you. It's wonderful to hear, but it's just very interesting to consider, does this make a difference to anything in terms of the actual halacha? Especially as, for example, we do not find the corresponding that says that they didn't bring you bread and water. However, Hashem fed you man from heaven and water from Mir as well, because he loves you, he didn't let you starve. We don't say that, because what Hashem did for us has nothing to do with what they wanted to do for us, or were not prepared to do for us. That seems to be the focus, Pasukei. So that's just a very interesting point to ponder, I believe, why we bring in this. It's an expression of love. It's an amazing thing. Does it actually contribute to our understanding of the halachas themselves? I have not had time to follow that up, but mention it just as a point for consideration. But what I'd like to focus on within this pasuk is pasuk vav begins below avo Hashem Elokecha lishmoa el Bilam. Hashem did not wish to listen to Bilam. Okay. Very good. Bilam wants to curse, and Hashem doesn't want that to happen. Now, the first person to mention this, that Hashem did not wish for him to curse the Jewish people, was actually Bilam in Parshas Balak. because when Bilam originally asks for permission to curse the Jewish people, Hashem says no, and Bilam has no choice but to get up the next morning and say, Hashem does not wish for me to go with you. And that is in Bamidbar, Perek Kaf Beis, Pasuk Yud Gimel, Bilam woke up, he said to Sarai and Midian, Me'ein Hashem, Lisiti la'lochim Hashem, Hashem doesn't want me to go with you. Now what's interesting is that we have a shift in phraseology between the way the Torah says what Hashem was not prepared to happen and the way Bilam says what Hashem did not wish to happen. The Torah uses the expression in our pasuk, "V'lo ava Hashem elokecha lishmo al Bilam." Hashem didn't want Bilam to listen to Bilam. Didn't want. Bilam doesn't say that. Bilam doesn't say, "Lo ava Hashem." Hashem doesn't want me to go with you. What he says is, "Me'ein Hashem, l'siti la'lochim Hashem." Hashem is refusing. And the delicate question is, the Lashon HaKodesh question is there a difference between saying a person doesn't want something or a person refuses to do something? Presumably, if you refuse, it's because you don't want. So it's two ways of saying the same thing. But why is it that Bilam chooses the expression me'ein, whereas the Torah chooses the expression v'lo ava? That's a good shaila. That's a parshanut question. And I mentioned it here, not only for this instance, but because there is another situation in our parsha where we have both of these terms in the same pasuk, and that will certainly sharpen for us the distinction between them. To what do I refer? In Perek Kafhei, in the opening psukim, so we have the mitzvah of Yibum. Of course, there's much to say about the Yibum, mitzvah Shem, we'll get there, but just for now, what is the situation of Yibum is that a person, Lo Aleinu, dies childless, his wife, Yibum says, should marry his brother. If they don't, so then they do chalitza and then they terminate that bond. And actually, Pasuk Zion talks about that situation. And what if he doesn't want to marry her? And by the way, he doesn't have to want to marry her. And by the same token, she doesn't have to want to marry him. The Torah doesn't force either of them. It gives them the possibility for all of the reasons that it's beneficial, but it does not force either of them. They didn't choose to marry each other, and they don't have to. But there is a process of ending the connection between them. The first thing is, v'olsa yivimto ashara, so the yivimto, that is to say, the widow of the first brother, she goes el azakenim, she goes to the elders, to the Sanhedrin, v'omra, and she says, and let us watch carefully what she says, me'ein yivami la'kim la'chiv shem b'Yisrael. My yovam, that is to say, my brother-in-law, he is refusing to perpetuate his brother's name. Lo ava yabmi, he doesn't want to do Yibum with me. So what's interesting here is that we have both expressions literally within a few words of each other. It begins by saying me'ein's refusing, and then ends off by saying lo ava, he doesn't want to do it. But that he's refusing because he doesn't want to do it. So this brings into even sharper focus these two terms and beckons us to ask, what is the difference between them? This question is discussed by Rav Naftali Weisel, who is quoted in the Drushes Afika Yehuda, of Yehuda Edel of Slonim. And the Afika Yehuda, he brings us the principle of Rav Naftali Weisel, and then he'll work with it, and then he'll go with it. The truth of the matter is, says Rav Naftali, is that there are really two reasons why a person would decline to do something. Either because they simply don't want to do it, or perhaps they do, but they're being held back by an external factor. Not everyone who refuses something is because they don't wish to do it. Maybe they do, but there's an overriding concern that mitigates here and leads to their refusal. Says Rav Tali Weisel, this is the difference between lo ava and me'ein. When you say lo ava, it's about what the person wants. Literally, it's about what the person wants. Lo ava, he didn't want. And of course, naturally, he'll refuse, unless he's forced to accept. But all things being equal, he'll refuse. But why only? Because he doesn't want. That's lo ava. However, me'ain, which the focus, when you think about it, even just on a simple level, is lo avos about what the person wants. Me'ain is what the person says. It's their stance. They're refusing. But you don't know why they're refusing. Perhaps they would like to do this, but something is forcing them to refuse. Something else is in play here, an overriding factor. And this, as Afike Yehuda will explain to us, the difference between how Bilam talks about Hashem's refusal and how Hashem talks about Hashem's refusal. In other words, there's a well-known statement, actually. Rashi quotes it from Chazal. Bilam felt a little bad about refusing the people. They'd come to him, would you curse the Jewish people? He has to ask permission, and permission was denied. But Bilam, in true form, covered hungry and haughty in that way, he made it feel like it was their fault. He actually says, Hashem doesn't let me go with you. And the operative word was with you, meaning with people like you, the proletariat, that's not worth it. And Hashem doesn't allow me to do that. He turned the no, but he turned it into, it's no, but it's your fault. I mean, you're the ones who are responsible. Which is why they sent back much more dignified emissaries. And to Bilam's, I don't know if I would say to his good fortune, because it was the beginning of the end for him, but then Hashem said yes. And Bilam spun that in fantastically. He said, you see, the first time you sent Sugbet. And Hashem said no. But then when you sent Mahadrin, so then Hashem said yes. But that wasn't true, of course. When Hashem says you can't, it's because Hashem didn't want him to go. But Bilam says no. You know what? Maybe he does want me to go. He'd be okay with me going, just not with you. And that's why Bilam uses the term me'ain, as if to say, I'm not saying he doesn't want, maybe he does, but he's refusing. There's something in the way. You know what that thing is? You. That's Bilam's response to that group. But of course, that wasn't true. I mean, that was a political saving of face on Bilam's part. But the truth comes out in our parsha. Hashem says, Bilam came to curse, and there's no me'ain. Lo av, Hashem didn't want him to curse you. That's what it's all about, right from the beginning. Bilam wasn't prepared to recognize it, but of course, it needs to be stated. And that's why you see again the difference when the Torah quotes someone. The Torah isn't undersigning the veracity of whatever it is they're saying. Bilam is lying. But the Torah quotes him because you need to see Bilam lying. It's the truth about his lie. But you also need to know the actual truth, which the Torah fills in here. That's me'ain from Bilam and lo ava from the Torah. And in fact, I saw just recently Rabbi Avram Gurwitz, Shlita, the Rosh Hashiva of Gateshead, he explains, and such a disarmingly simple comment, now that we're wise in this matter. Beginning of Megillas Esther, you have the party, first 180 days and the 7 days. On day 7, the final day, Ahasuerus calls for Vashti to come. Everyone should see how beautiful she was. And Vashti refuses. And there's a very well-known statement of the Gemara. Children know it, but adults should also know it, because it was meant for the Jewish people. Something happened to Vashti. She got sarah, she got whatever it was, she grew a tail, something happened, and whatever that means. But that's very interesting. Because, again, to understand Divrei Chachamim, what they mean by these things, but one thing is for sure, it sounds like there was some external reason why Vashti didn't come. As if to say, when we read the Megillah, so we think Vashti refused. Why did she refuse? Because she was uppity, because she was she's not interested in going. But when you think about it, whatever the problem was, it really sounds like maybe she was interested in going, but something prevented her. Were it not for her tzaras, were it not for whatever, she would have gone, but this thing held her back. But how does the Gemara know that? So Rabbi Avram says, because the pasuk says, Vatima'ein, Hamalka Vashti, Vatima'ein always has the connotation of, she would be open to going, but something held her back. What was that thing? Whatever the Gemara says. But we see there was more to it than just Vashti refusing because she wasn't interested. If she categorically wasn't interested, it would have said velo av savashti lavo, she didn't want to go. But it doesn't say that. It says she refused, implying in spite of the fact that she may have wanted to go, something else made her refuse. Continuing in this vein, because you see how it, paying attention to the difference, what appear to be synonyms in Lashon HaKodesh, but really are two different tracks entirely. The Afike Yehuda draws our attention to the pasuk in Mishlei, where Shlomo HaMelech says towards the beginning, Bini, he always calls his reader Bini, if you learn from him, you're his son, as Chazal tell us. Im yifatucha chatoim, if sinners, if they try and entice you, they try and get you into, be part of their group, al tove, don't listen to them and don't go that way. Don't be swayed by them. As he goes on to say, they'll promise you everything, easy living, life of crime, etc. It will all end badly. Aside from the fact that it's wrong, it will end badly. But what's interesting is, here too, Shlomo HaMelech doesn't say, if people try and entice you to a way of crime, refuse. Just say no. It doesn't say that. It says, lo tove, you shouldn't wish to go in that direction. And that really is a major theme within what Sefer Mishlei is all about. As if to say, Sefer Mishlei is not just about good behavior. It's about good characteristics. The ideal is not that you refuse to enter a life of crime. The ideal is that you should not wish for such a thing. You should recognize its flaws and its deficiencies. And the truth is, this leads us straight to the Rambam, his famous discussion in the Shemona Prokhim, in his 8 introductory chapters to Pirkei Avos. In Perek Vav there, he has an interesting shaila. He quotes it as an earlier question. He comes to Arbiter. And the question is, what's better? What type of person is better? Someone who has negative tendencies but overcomes them. That's good, in a way. He's exerting moral force here. Or perhaps a person who doesn't have such bad tendencies in the first place. He's naturally good. And that's the question. Who is better? Someone who's naturally good, or someone who perhaps says, no, he's not naturally good, but he does the right thing. Maybe he's better. That's the question. And the Rambam makes a famous chiluk. He distinguishes between different types of mitzvahs. There are mitzvahs that you could call moral mitzvahs. Not to steal, not to kill, not to injure, not to damage, and such like. One could almost group them all in Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. And those are called mitzvos sichlios. Okay, seichel will tell you. But there are other mitzvos. Mitzvos shimios. The Torah forbids it. Had the Torah not forbidden it, one would not have categorized it intuitively or spontaneously, independently, as immoral. It's now immoral because it's immoral to do what the Torah tells you not to do. But not what we could call naturally immoral. For example, milk and meat, kashrus, shatnas, and so on and so forth. Or certain forbidden relationships. The Torah says no. And the Rambam says, when it comes to the first category, mitzvos sichlios, so it's not right, it's not correct to say that if a person has tendencies towards violence and theft and bloodshed, but he overcomes them, he's a better person. How can you call him a better person? He's a corrupt person. What type of person is a tendency toward violence? But it's not a negative statement about someone's character if they have a tendency towards non-kosher food. It's not a moral issue. It's a Torah issue. It's a prohibition of the Torah. And on the contrary, there, the Rambam quotes the well-known statement of the Medrash, a person should not say that I could never stand to eat non-kosher food. You shouldn't say that. You should say, you know, I would do it, but the Torah says not to. That's where the mitzvah is. It doesn't make you a better person that you naturally would not do this if you can't understand why the Torah forbids it in the first place. And therefore, because this chapter, coming back to the beginning of Mishlei, because it says, if these people, these criminals, they're trying to get you into their group, al tove. Why? Because they're talking about hunting people. They're talking about violence and theft and bloodshed if necessary. Those are mitzvos sichlios. As the Rambam has told us, mitzvos sichlios, the ideal is not, I'd love to be a criminal, but but I refuse. I assert my moral obligation to refuse. No, a person shouldn't want to things that belong to someone else or to do them harm, etc. And that's why, with regards to the type of sins that Shlomo is talking about, he says, Al Tova, that's the ideal. Not Tima'en. Do not refuse. Don't want it in the first place. And Achar Hadvarim Ha'ele, if we come back to our parsha, close the circle, that pasuk in Yibum. Perik Kafhei, pasuk Zion. We noted that both terms are used. It begins Me'ein and concludes Lo Ava. And what is behind the shift? Says the Afike Yehuda, in this pasuk, both types of refusal are represented. For the simple reason, in a general case, a person, or Aleinu, the brother died childless, and you have an opportunity to help them, especially as we'll see, whoever does Yibum inherits the brother, which means that it's win-win, you're helping your brother, helping yourself, etc. and so forth. It's rare to find a person, it's always possible, but it's rare to find a person who would not inherently or intrinsically wish to help his brother. There's just one thing. The Torah has a very specific way that it happens, and that is through marrying the brother's widow. And that may not be something that he's prepared to do. And it doesn't say anything bad, not about him and not about her, but the reason why they didn't marry each other in the first place, and that's probably the reason why they don't want to get married now. But if that's true, then either his or her disinclination to marry each other will result in the refusal to go through with Yibum, even though it's something that they maybe in principle would have wanted to do, but not in this way. And that's why what she says is Me'ein Yivami Lakim Lachiv Shem Yisrael. She begins by saying he's refusing. She doesn't say he doesn't want to do it, because maybe he does, but he's refusing. And what's the basis of his refusal, again, or her refusal? Lo ava yavmi, because it's about us marrying each other, and that's something that he doesn't want to do. And therefore, because of the lo ava, which is about the actual wish, yes or no, with regards to the marriage itself, that leads to the refusal, the mi'un, with regards to the yibum. So here is, again, well, on the one hand, we're very much in the halachas, we're very much in the mitzvahs, but you see how if we identify a certain principle, how it illuminates in so many places. And for all the instances that we've mentioned, there are many more that have not been mentioned, something to think about as we go through the Chumash and go through the Nevi'im and Ksuvim. Now, we're in the mitzvah of Yibum, having landed there. And let us now just go back to Pasuk Vav. Perek Kafhei, Pasuk Vav. Or to give full background, to go back to Pasuk Hei. Ki yeshvu achim yachtav, brothers that live together. Umeis achad mehem uvein ein lo. One of them, lo aleinu, who dies without children. Lo siya eishas hameis achutza leish zar. So his widow should not immediately... is not available to marry someone else. There's something that needs to happen, and if it doesn't happen, it needs to be dealt with and terminated. The brother of the original husband, so they perform yibum. And then pasuk vav, and we should watch this pasuk very carefully. And it shall be the firstborn that she bears. Yakum Hashem Achiv Ameis. So he should rise up and take the place Al Shem on the the name of the brother. V'lo Yimachesh Shemo B'Yisrael, that his name should not be erased from Israel. Now, this pasuk is very interesting, because if we take a look at the pshat of the pasuk, it reads a certain way, and that is not what the halacha is, as we will see. Once again, the pshat. Vaya. So they've now they're doing this yibum marriage. Habechoresh etere, the firstborn child. Yakum Hashem Achiv Ameis. So the instruction is that he should then assume the name of the deceased brother, so that his name should not be erased from Israel. B'nei Macheshem of Israel. So the bechor in this instance is the child who has not yet been born, the child that will come from this yibum marriage. However, the halacha is that this pasuk is taken as saying something else entirely, based on a gezeira shava. We're not going into those details. That habechor asher teled actually refers to the eldest brother, that is to say, not the newborn child who doesn't yet exist, but the eldest brother, as if to say, if there are a number of brothers who could potentially do yibum, the mitzvah is that the firstborn among the brothers, that is to say, brothers of the deceased husband, should do yibum. And moreover, Yakum Hashem Achiv Hameis, Achiv now is him, he is the subject. And he now rises up and inherits the brother. So that's quite different. I just wish to summarize because it's important to have these two in front of us. The pshat seems to say that the firstborn child, once they get married, should rise up and assume the name of the dead brother. But the halacha says, no, it is the oldest among the surviving brothers, that bechor, he is the one that should perform yibum, and then he is the one that inherits the brothers. Ramban comments on this. And Ramban says something very interesting. He provides us, because what we're saying, the pasuk would seem to say that the mitzvah is that the first child, he should get the name of the deceased brother. Says Ramban, but we know that it doesn't mean that. And how do we know it doesn't mean it? Einenu kipshuto, three or four lines of Ramban. Einenu kipshuto. It is not like the pshat suggests, not practically, sheikru'u haben harishon b'shem ha'meis. The literal reading sounds like the first child is born, give him the name of the deceased brother, of the deceased husband. Ruvein or Shimon kamohu. And how do I know that that's not so? Because we have a situation where these words were aired, and this was the concern, and it didn't happen. Boaz. Shari Boaz Ne'emar, these words are essentially reverberate there. Velo yikareis shema meis me'im echav umishar mekomo, let the name of the brother, machlo, let the name of the brother, let it not be erased, etc. And so they got married, and they had a child, and they called him Oved, not machlo. After the whole build-up, after the whole, you brought together the whole thing, velo koros machlo. And you see from there that it was understood that's not really what the pasuk is saying. Not practically. The bechor with the name, it's not about giving him the name of the deceased brother. It's about the eldest brother doing yibum. But then the Ramban has a final line here. Aval hakosuv hazeh al derech ha'emes havtocha. In terms of Derech HaEmes, and when the Ramban uses the expression Derech HaEmes, that's his way of referring to Kabbalah. When it comes to the more inner, mystical, nister part of what's going on here, it's not a mitzvah, these words, that the Bechor will rise up in his name. It's a promise. V'hinehu kipshuto. And thus the pasuk is kipshuto. And what does he mean? What the Ramban is saying is, you know, the fact remains that the pshat of the pasuk, habechor asher teled, it is about the child that will then be born. That's the pshat. Except we've demonstrated that as a mitzvah, it doesn't exist to call him after this. So and therefore the halacha shifts. But there's still room for the pshat, not to teach you the halacha, but to teach you something else about yibum. And that is the ongoing question, which we've mentioned many times in these discussions, when we talk about pshat. And there are times when the pshat and the halacha do not coincide. But that is not the end of the discussion, that's the beginning of the discussion. As if to say, however you establish, and there's rules for halacha to establish, to expand halacha. Once you've established that the halacha and the pshat do not coincide, that's not the time to move on. That's the time to ask, so what is the pshat doing if it's not teaching me the halacha? The pshat of ayin tachas ayin is an eye for an eye. It's not the halacha. But you need to then go back and ask, so why did the Torah write the pshat in a way which is not the halacha? It's got to teach me something. These were of Kupperman's famous two questions, Sheilat HaKetzad and Sheilat HaMadua. The question of how and the question of why. How means how do you know that the halacha is not as the pshat would indicate. And for that, you take recourse to the Midas of Medrash Halacha, the Gemara, the Chazal, and so forth. But then, having established that, the question is, madua? So then why did the Torah write the pshat in a way which is not the halacha? Or in Rav Kupperman's words, the pshat might not be teaching me halacha, but it's got to be teaching me Torah. Which means there is some part of the Torah's message that the pshat is covering alongside the halacha. Rav Kupperman established 11 possibilities, which became the basis of his sefer Pshita Shamikra, and one of them really comes out from the Ramban here, because the Ramban says that, you know, yibum, and if there is ever a mitzvah where this sort of thing is discussed, so to speak, openly, it is the mitzvah of yibum, because it's written into the mitzvah of yibum. The Ramban, not here, but earlier on in Parshas Vayeshev, where you have almost like the first version of yibum. It's before Matan Torah, and it's not the mitzvah per se, but with Yehuda, and there the Ramban talks about it, and Ramban says, I believe it's quite well known, but important to phrase it correctly, that essentially what's happening here is that through yibum the conditions are that this poor soul who left the world without any surviving issue and any descendants, he has a chance to come back, but it's only with people that have a sufficient affinity with him, namely his wife and his brother, and that's what yibum is all about, essentially. Says Ramban, and that's what Ramban means when he says al derech ha'emes. Now that's not a halacha lemaisa. It doesn't affect halacha. It's just the innerness behind the halacha. And so Ramban says, well, if you look at the pasuk again, v'hayad b'chor asher teled yakum hashem achiv hames, the new child, he will then rise up as on the name of the dead brother. That's not a mitzvah. But it's the reality of what yibum is. It's the inner reality. But that's the Torah's haftacha. The Torah says what will happen. But that's not the Torah telling you what you should do. But that's the pshat. And this brings us to a very interesting situation. Because it emerges that in this instance, pshuto shel mikra, what the pshat is teaching you in the mitzvah of yibum, is not the halacha. But it's teaching you, in a sense, the mystical underpinnings of the mitzvah. And the reason why that's so interesting, as Rav Kupperman himself expresses it, is because, generally speaking, we are accustomed to the level, shall we say, of this pshat, and then there's drash, and then there's remes, and then there's sod. And pshat, in a sense, is the simplest reading of the pasuk, and that generally checks out, or parallels, or corresponds to, shall we say, the simplest perception of events. And then the drash goes a bit deeper in the pasuk, and that represents a deeper understanding of events. And then remez and sod. Here we have an unusual situation. It's specifically the pshat, which is the most revealed way of accessing the Torah's message, that gives us the sod, that gives us the deepest level of what's actually going on. So in other words, it almost loops around the halacha. Generally speaking, you have the pshat, and then deeper than that is the halacha, and then deeper than that is the sod. Here, the pshat, it is bypassed as the halacha, but it actually tells you the sod. So the most revealed and most manifest level is actually reflecting the deepest level of understanding. That is one for the books. And interestingly, Rav Kupperman points out another example of this from Rabbeinu Bachya in Parshas Balosava, and Rabbeinu Bachya is the same Beis HaMedrash as the Ramban. Rabbeinu Bachya is a Talmud of the Rashba. Rashba himself was a Talmud of Ramban. And what's interesting here is that I think we're all familiar with the Pasuk, but we might not necessarily be bothered by the question. But the Mefarshim are. In the beginning of Parshas Balosava, the lighting of the menorah, the Pasuk is well known, Balosava Saneiros, when you raise the lights, El mul panei ha-menorah ya'ir shiva saneiros. El mul panei ha-menorah, so facing inwards, panei ha-menorah is the middle light, panei ha-menorah, the panim. El mul, they all, as we know, they all face towards the middle, ya'ir shiva saneiros. Okay. Now, if you're yekish, you'll have a problem here. Because if the panei ha-menorah itself is one of the lights, you don't actually have seven lights facing inwards. because inwards is one of them. You have six lights facing inwards. It's fair to say, and that's how we describe it, if we would paraphrase, we would say, the menorah, you've got the light in the middle, and then the other six face inwards. Three on one side, three on the other. So essentially, el mul panei ha-menorah, yairu, sheishes ha-neiros. Six of them are facing inwards, because number seven is already in. It's not facing itself. It's a good shayla. And Mefarshei HaPshat, of course, one has to work it out. There's many, many different approaches. But Rabbeinu Bachya, and Rabbeinu Bachya himself presents, but concludes by saying that al derech hasod, that in more, again, Kabbalah, plain, you can read the pasuk kipshuta. Because the Kabbalah understanding of Pnei HaMenorah, is a higher concept, as if to say, you have the menorah down here, and the lights go up, and in so doing, they resonate with, and they connect with, a higher menorah, and that's what brings down the divine illumination. However it does, we're not going to go into those details. But that's why it says Ba'alosach HaSaneiros, because for our menorah, the lights go up. But correspondingly, something goes down from a concept which is called Pnei HaMenorah. So our menorah faces that higher menorah. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, in terms of facing the higher menorah, it is all seven of the lights down here that light upwards and face towards Pnei HaMenorah. And that is the pasuk Kipshuto, El Mul Pnei HaMenorah. If you understand Pnei HaMenorah in this more nistar way, in this more mystical way, Pnei HaMenorah is a higher concept, then you can read the pasuk kipshuto, that corresponding to this higher concept, all seven of the lower lights face towards it. And when you think about it, it is exactly what the Ramban said. As if to say, you have an amazing bringing together of the simplest reading of the pasuk, which gives you these esoteric concepts, and everything in between is the halacha and needs to be worked out. So that's certainly very valuable discussion with regards to the role of Pshuta Shemek. Let's conclude by referring to a pasukim at the end of the parsha, which is Perek Kafhei, pasuk Yud Gimel and Tet Zayin. Weights and measures. Lo yielacha bekisra evin va'avin. Gedola ketana. Do not have two types of weights. One for the buyer, one for the seller. One for when you're buying, one for when you're selling. No. Lo yielacha bebeischa eifa ve'eifa. Not two types of volume measures. Gedola ketana. Everything's got to be uniform. Evin shlema v'tzedek yielach. Eifa shlema v'tzedek yielach. It's all got to be uniform. No trickery. Because to cheat in business is an abomination to have such a thing. Now, the psukim are well known. What's very interesting about these psukim is that they have a unique status in that they are reiterated later on in Tanakh, specifically in Sefer Mishlei, three times. We'll just take a look at one of them, but on no less than three occasions, Shlomo HaMelech talks about this, faulty weights and measures, in Sefer Mishlei. For example, Perek Kaf, Pasuk Yud, Evin va'Evin, Eifa va'Eifa. If you have this stone and that stone, this Eifa and that Eifa, this measure, that, meaning disparate weights and measures, Tov Asa Hashem Gam Shnehem. Each of those is, Tov Asa Hashem, is an abomination before Hashem. Now, the question, of course, is what is this pasuk doing in Mishlei? And there's more than one way to ask this question. Firstly, it seems to be out of place in Mishlei, because Mishlei is about, shall we say, being moral, being upright. It's not about Isser V'Heter. Shlomo HaMelech doesn't tell you not to steal and not to kill. The Torah does that. Shlomo HaMelech talks about morals, etc., in a sense, what's behind that. So to get into a Choshen Mishpat Sugya in the middle of Mishlei, that seems to be a little bit out of place, especially as Shlomo HaMelech seems to be practically word for word quoting the Torah. Because the Torah says you shouldn't have this stone and that stone because it's a toeva. And Shlomo HaMelech says if you have this stone and that stone, it's a toeva. So leave it to the Chumash for this. Rabbeinu Yonah explains, Rabbeinu Yonah in his commentary to Sefer Mishlei there. And he takes us back to the earlier pasuk. And as we'll see, it's a fitting, shall we say, conclusion to our discussion this evening. Pasuk Tes of Perek Kaf says, Mi yomar zikisi libi. Who can say zikisi from the word zach, that I've completely refined my heart, taharti mechatai, fully pure from my sins, mechatosi. Now what is the meaning of that? Who can say I'm fully refined, fully pure? Rabbeinu Yonah says that this is a discussion about what Sefer Mishlei is all about. As if to say, there could perhaps be a notion that, why do I need Sefer Mishlei? I mean, what is Sefer Mishlei saying? You should develop good characteristics. What difference does it make what characteristics I have? Shlomo HaMelech says, don't be greedy. Maybe I should be greedy. Or maybe it doesn't matter if I'm greedy. As long as I don't steal, as long as I don't cheat, as long as I don't hurt anyone, what difference does it make what I'm thinking or what I'm feeling? Why should I work on those tendencies? As long as I can restrain them and no one gets hurt, what difference does it make? But the answer here is it makes all the difference in the world, and you can see it from the Torah. Because the Torah is not just looking for good behavior. The goal of the Torah is elevated people. And a person who is greedy and selfish and has all these things, but he just stops himself from acting on it, that's not a success. He's contained damage, but that's not a success. Success is the person himself. And how do we see it? So amazingly, Shlomo HaMelech brings a mitzvah from the Torah in Mishlei because he wants to use it as a mashal. How so? Well, it's very interesting, and perhaps it's easy to identify with. The Torah forbids having faulty weights and measures in one's house. The Torah doesn't just say, you know, don't cheat in business. The Torah doesn't say that. We're not here. The Torah says more. The Torah says it's an abomination to have something like that in your. Why? Because the very essence of this thing, it's deceit. To have these two measures, don't even have them in your house. It's an Isser Torah. But what does that tell you? That tells you that one person could say, you know what? My house will be full of these measures. I'll never use them. But the Torah says, but that's not good enough. What are they doing in your house? They're an abomination. Their essence says cheating. That is a problem even before we get to you cheating. And that's an Isser Torah. And Shlomo HaMelech says, and it's a perfect mashal for what we're saying. And that's why it's in Mishlei. In the same way that the Torah says, you know, there's certain things that they are intrinsically wrong. And it's an abomination even without acting on them because of what they represent. That's what we're talking about when we talk about these greedy tendencies and selfishness and negativity. And that's why the first pasuk says, Mi yomar zikisi libi, who can say I've refined my heart? As if to say, Shlomo HaMelech is saying, you should refine your heart. And should you say, what difference does it make if my heart is refined? As long as my actions are okay, maybe I don't need to refine my heart. But the very next pasuk says, no, remember that mitzvah about different weights. They're a to'eva just having them because of what they bespeak. And well, because of what they embody, and because of what they represent. And so too, a heart that has all these negative things. That's why Sefer Mishlei exists, in order to get to work on refining the heart. There should be nothing, the equivalent of faulty measures, within the house of the person. And this brings us back to what the Afike Yehuda said. In the beginning of Mishlei, Mifatucha Chatoim, if they try and entice you, al tover, you shouldn't even, that's the goal. Not don't get into league with them. You shouldn't even be interested. And that's called refining the heart. That's the goal of Mishlei, elaborating upon this mitzvah within our parsha. We'll leave it over there.